second panel of the conference on transnational anarchism in the Americas. It is my pleasure to introduce our speakers today, some fellow anarcho-history nerds. Unfortunately, Amparo Sanchez-Cobos is ill, and she will not be able to join us today to talk about Spanish anarchists in Cuba. But if you read Spanish, her book on the topic was published in 2008. So, recommend it. Introducing in the order that they will be speaking. First up today will be Travis Tomczyk, who completed a history PhD at Queen's University last November. His dissertation focused on transnational Italian anarchism, or Italian anarchist networks in southern Ontario in the northeast United States between 1915 and 1940. The next speaker that will be David Turcato, who is from Italy, lives in Vancouver, whose alter identity is working in the IT industry, but he is also an independent, or not independent scholar, as he just finished his PhD recently as well. He's working on turning that dissertation into a book on Malatesta, titled Making Sense of Anarchism. He is also compiling and editing an Italian 10-volume collected works of Malatesta. And finally, we have Jeffrey de la Facore, my French pronunciation is a travesty, who is an associate professor of history at Norfolk State University in Virginia. He does work on the history of labor and social movements in the Atlantic world, and in particular on anarchist currents in Argentina. And without further ado, we will have Travis up speaking on the radical culture of Italian anarchists in North America.
Okay. So during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, it's constituted a period of intense cultural output by the left, and anarchists were no exception. They created an enormous diversity of artistic and cultural forms to challenge capitalism, unite activists, and direct political action. These forms included newspapers, political cartoons, drama societies, and radical holidays. Whether it was the radical plays of Pietro Gori, performed by amateur dramatic societies known as Philo Dramatique, or the numerous social events organized to raise funds for the movement, anarchists use art and culture to resist the role of government and capital in creating patriotic and hardworking citizens committed to the perpetuation of the status quo. As historian Salvatore Salerno has shown in his study on the culture and art of the industrial workers of the world, these forms were also, quote, a means of unifying workers and a basis from which to move against the oppressive social conditions of industrial development that extended beyond the point of production. Close quotes. As an oppositional ideology, anarchism not only had to demonstrate that there were alternatives to the capitalist liberal democratic order, but was also required to develop strategies for building and maintaining these movements. For Italian anarchists, these goals were accomplished in a variety of ways. Newspapers were an important means of communicating anarchist theories and views on current topics to the movement faithful as well as potential adherents. Paul Haverich has suggested that between 1870 and 1940, as many as 500 anarchist periodicals were produced in the United States, with Italian output consisting of one-fifth of that total. Publications like the anarchist syndicalist Il Martello and the anti-organizationalist anarcho-communist Radunata dei Refrattari, both based in New York City, acted as a form of historical memory by printing commemorative obituaries to radicals past or featuring articles on aspects of anarchist history, such as the Paris Commune of 1870. Additionally, the last pages of Il Martello and La Dunata were reserved for anarchist circles around North America to advertise social and cultural events in various localities in Canada and the United States. If these events advertised by these circles were fundraisers, which they often were, each group would give an account of the money raised, the cost to hold the event, and how much money remained after costs were covered, and of course the cost for which the money had been collected. For example, a notice from Detroit's Il Gruppo I Refrattari was placed in the January 6, 1940 issue of La Dunata, stating that Philodramatica Aurora would be performing two plays at Detroit's Carpathia Hall on January 20th, 1940. There was a drama and a comedy that were performed. The plays were followed by a dance with music performed by a live orchestra. Food and refreshments were also available to those who showed up. And the price of admission for the event was 35 cents per person, and the money raised after expenses was to be donated to political prisoners. Now, 4 weeks after this event was held, a follow-up notice would be posted by Il Gruppo Irrefrattari and La Donata, stating how much money had been raised. So, for instance, $440 came in at the door, while expenses totaled $272.10. So the remaining $139.30 was to be divided among three different funds for political prisoners as follows. There was the Bortolotti Confortieri Defense Fund in Toronto. These are two Italian anarchists that were under threat of being deported from Canada from beginning of fall 1939 to 1940. If anyone's curious about that story, I can elaborate on it in the Q&A session. So the Bortolotti Confortieri Defense Fund in Toronto received $50 of that money raised, while $44.65 was given to political victims in Italy, and then also another $44.65 to the persecuted of Europe, two other political prisoner defense funds that were coordinated by the La Donata dei Refrattari paper. But newspapers were not the only form of anarchist literature. Many pamphlets and books were published either by those responsible for movement newspapers or by others in their spare time. Social events such as dances, dinners, and plays performed by Philodramatica or amateur dramatic societies, generally open to the wider Italian neighborhood, also provided a way to attract new adherents. These social events combined entertainment and fundraising. The plays were often local productions, though some of the drama groups did tours of Italian communities to a limited extent. Plays dealt with anarchist themes such as worker exploitation under capitalism and the hypocrisy of religion, among others. The plays of anarchist songwriter and poet Pietro Gori were a popular choice among Philodramatica, especially Primo Maggio, which celebrated May 1st and called on workers to engage in revolutionary action. Gori's plays were transnational and were performed by Italian anarchists in Canada, the U.S., and other countries where Italian anarchists settled. However, the performance of plays written by less well-known anarchists was also common. In addition to writing plays, anarchists also wrote politically oriented fiction. In 1916, Osvaldo Meraviglia, who would later become the treasurer of La Donata dei Refrattari, produced a book-length manuscript about life during the First World War. It is not clear whether this novel was ever published, either in book form or as a series of installments in an anarchist journal, and it is quite possible that no manuscript of this work exists today. Italian authorities caught wind of the manuscript after it was intercepted in the mail. A military censor stationed in Genoa had been reading Meraviglia's incoming and outgoing mail because the anarchist's letters were of a subversive and anti-militarist nature. The anarchist had sent the manuscript to his sister, Isolina Meraviglia, a teacher who lived in the Marche region of Italy, to be proofread. The story centered around two estranged stepbrothers who share a German father, but had grown up in two different countries, France and Germany. Both had enlisted in the armies of the respective nations, and due to unexplained circumstances, came face to face on the battlefield. The lieutenant colonel who wrote the report from which this information is drawn had this to say about Meraviglia's manuscript. While the first part of the novel does not contain anything to censor, towards the end and in the commentary, there are phrases of marked subversive character. The report contained two excerpts from the manuscript, though the passages are not attributed to either of the stepbrothers or any character in the novel. The first passage seems to be spoken by someone, possibly one of the brothers, who comes to the realization that war pits workers from one country against those of another. And this is here I'm quoting from the actual manuscript. Quote, such is the horror of war. It really is true what the anarchists and the socialists say, that war must not be made between workers. The war is fratricide. It is disgraceful, close quote. And the second excerpt, it is not clear where Meraviglia is directing his contempt towards the military's rank and file or its generals. And this is a bit of a longer passage from that manuscript. It is also true that they are of the assassins, of the cowardly, of the seducers of our systems, these men, that have their petty medals and crosses. They are more than delinquents, and every one of these medals and crosses represents who knows how many crimes they have committed. But this goes unnoticed by the people who, as the old heroes pass by, bow, take off their hats, and erect monuments, because these vile achievements have their reward. And we repeat the words of our rebel poets, no countries, no borders, and the people united. As his repressed manuscript reveals, Maravilla, like many anarchists, saw novel writing as a political movement. Another way to reach prospective members was through public speaking. A public lecture brought Catino D'Amico into the anarchist movement. She had heard Luigi Galliani, the editor of the anarchist journal Cronica Subversiva, who was deported from the U.S. Back to Italy in 1919, speak at an open-air meeting as a teenager and was impressed by what he said and the way in which he delivered his speech. Recalling that event, D'Amico stated, "Galliani spoke directly to my heart." She then became an active anarchist in Brooklyn and took part in picnics, philodramatica, and other activities. Prominent anarchists would tour Italian communities speaking on a wide variety of subjects, from anarchism to Italian literature. If anarchist comrades found themselves in trouble with authorities, these speaking tours were an invaluable means to raise awareness and support for this cause. In addition to tours, anarchists also spoke publicly during strikes and anti-fascist rallies. Anarchist circles were the lifeblood of the Italian movement. It was these groups that supported movement newspapers and sometimes established their own, organized social and cultural events, hosted lecturers, and engaged in various kinds of activism within Italian communities. They also provided a space for anarchists to meet and discuss anarchist philosophy and tactics, social and political issues, as well as maintain existing social ties and develop new ones. Anarchist circles were usually titled by words that reflected the philosophy's ethos. Volonta, will, libertà, liberty, and pensiero, thought. Groups were also named after anarchist journals. Both Il Martello and La Donata dei Refrattari had groups comprised of those members, editorial staff of those papers, as well as others who were not. Among the Italian anarchists in North America, it does not appear to have been common practice to name their anarchist groups or circles after well-known Italian figures. However, some did, and for instance, one would be Il Gruppo Femminile Luisa Michel, based in Springfield, Illinois, named after the French anarchist and communard. Anarchist groups typically met every week in a variety of different locations. Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario's Il Gruppo Libero Pensiero, and yes, there was an Italian anarchist circle in Sault Ste. Marie. So they bought or rented a 150-person capacity hall on Albert Street West, located in the predominantly Italian community of Sault Ste. Marie's West End. The size of the building made it an ideal location for holding social events like dances and plays. Another option could be for groups to construct their own meeting place, though it is uncertain how frequent this occurred among Italian anarchists. According to Evaristo Ricciardelli, a member of Il Gruppo Libertà from Needham, Massachusetts, anarchists built what he described as a clubhouse located on Satchel Street. Building, renting, or buying space was an expensive proposition for working class movements, so meeting in members' homes was generally a less costly alternative. Unfortunately, Italian anarchists did not leave behind much information regarding the creation and history of the particular circles to which they belonged. Many who migrated to North America during the 1920s and 30s joined groups that were already in existence in North America. Others created their own circles after meeting like-minded fellow travelers. These circles ranged in size. Toronto's Il Gruppo Libertario, for instance, had but 12 members, while Il Gruppo Libertà, where I just mentioned from Needham, Massachusetts, numbered about 30. However, given the lack of its membership lists, it's difficult to know the size of other anarchist circles in North America, and trying to recreate them through available materials leads to an incomplete picture. It is quite likely that groups can number less than 12 and in excess of 30. Though anarchists were not a large demographic within Italian communities in North America, they still had an influence stronger than their members might suggest. As historian Jennifer Guglielmo has argued, this was due to the establishment of, quote, quite visible alternative cultural and political spaces in their neighborhoods, which became popular centers for immigrant education, political discussion, labor organizing, and recreation, close quote. Of equal importance was their ability to fundraise, not only for anarchist causes abroad, but also to maintain their own institutions, such as halls and journals. These groups and all the remarkable diversity made up Italian anarchism's vibrant transnational cultural network. Anarchist circles use social and cultural events not only to educate and entertain, but also to mobilize the members. Thanks.
All right, next up, we have David Tricato speaking on Biography, Anarchism, and Transnationalism.
At the opening session yesterday, someone told a little episode about she was talking to someone about this conference and how it was organized. And the other person showed surprise and said, "Oh, really, do anarchists organize?" And this kind of stereotype is also present in the historiography of anarchism. Anarchists are often presented as irrational or even stupid people. And the driving principle in my writing about the history of anarchism has been that whenever anarchists look stupid to historians, chances are that the historians are stupid in that they don't understand properly how the anarchist movement functions. And today I'm focusing on one aspect, which is the transnational dimension of anarchist movements, in particular the Italian movement. And the argument is that understanding this dimension is necessary in order to understand how the movement functions and how we can rescue the anarchist movement from this impression of irrationality. And particularly, I would like to show how two different approaches to the historiography of anarchism, the biographical and the collective ones, jointly point in this direction, in showing how the transnational dimension is relevant. The historiography of anarchism poses a special problem in that, for example, the institutional approach is often not available. Since there were formal organizations and parties on which the historian can focus, the historian has to look elsewhere for evidence about how the movement functioned. And one approach is the biographical approach, focusing on specific individuals. And another approach is to focus on the collective movement. And this is often done by focusing on one particular territory to see how the movement, what happened in that particular territory. And both approaches have problems. If you look at, I'm talking about the biographical approach first. If you look at the table that I distributed, and for example, you look at Malatesta's life, you can see that Malatesta lived in Italy for very short periods of time, and he was all over the place, in North Africa, all countries of Europe, North America, South America. And the impression that these biographies give is often that of romantic wanderers, knight errants, moved by the thirst for action, and never on top of things, but most often at the mercy of events. On the other hand, the collective approach to the history of anarchism often shows a pattern of cyclical pattern of appearances and disappearances of a movement in one country. And so this pattern is one of outbreaks of revolt followed by periods of quiescence and then resurgences. And for the biographical approach, the most frequent reference, the literary reference is to the Odyssey or to the Don Quixote. And for the collective history, the most frequent images are the phoenix, which dies and is born again from its own ashes, or Sisyphus. Now, both types of accounts lack a sense of continuity. For the biographical approach, the lack is of geographical continuity. So, for example, Malatesta operates in Italy for a short period of time and then seems to forget about Italy, goes elsewhere, and then comes back after a few years, and then again takes part in the struggle in Italy, and then is expelled or goes to jail, and then moves to another country. And in the case of collective history, the lack of continuity is more chronological. So you have these appearances of the movement, and then people disappear, you don't know where they go, and then they come back as if by some sort of spontaneous process. Now, I think that, as I said, biography and collective history can shed light on each other and work together towards a more adequate account of anarchist movements. The fact that exile and emigration were shared by most anarchists make these collective traits of the movements rather than individual peculiarities. And on the other hand, the fact that a significant part of a country's anarchist movement lived abroad suggests that the scope of a historian's analysis should transcend national borders. So I think that collective history and biography converge in identifying the transnational framework of analysis as the most fruitful one. And I would like to illustrate this point by comparing the lives of three foremost Italian anarchists, Enrico Malatesta, Francesco Saverio Merlino, and Pietro Gori. And the purpose of this comparison is to seek commonalities and intersections in the lives of these militants. So the table I distributed summarizes the places of residence of these three anarchists during a period of over three decades. And the table is the simplification of the actual timelines in that it adopts the principle 1 year, one country, even for years when there was a split between two countries for a given individual. Now, at first sight, the table looks a mess. So these anarchists were all over the place. But if you look more carefully, you start seeing some recurrences. And the first relevant aspect is the recurrence of certain foreign countries. For example, all three anarchists lived in England and the United States. Both Malatesta and Gori lived for extended periods of time in Argentina. And this was no coincidence. The set of foreign countries in which these three militants lived substantially overlaps with the area where Italian workers emigrated, and at the same time the area where colonies of anarchists were present. So not just the country I just mentioned, but the others as well, Europe, North Africa, North America, and South America. Draw the map of the transnationalism both of Italian workers and of the Italian anarchist movement. And a second point is that despite their mobility, these militants are often found in the same country at the same time. So, I highlighted the years where there is a simultaneous presence of two or more of these anarchists in the same country in both fates. So, in 1883-84, Malatesta was in Italy, came back to Italy from Egypt, and started working together with Merlino, and then they both underwent a trial together, and they escaped conviction by going in different directions. So one went to Argentina, the other to England. But when Malatesta came back to Europe, he went to England, where Merlino was, and they started working together again. And then it was Merlino's time to travel to other countries, France, Germany, United States. But then in 1893, he came back to England again, and again he worked together with Malatesta, and together in 1894 they came to Italy, and at that point they parted ways because Merlino was in prison. So he stayed in prison for 4 years, actually 3 years, and then afterwards he abandoned the anarchist movement, and this is why I grayed out the years after 1898. But at this point, the same pattern can be seen in Malatesta's life and Gori's life. So they were together in Italy in they were together in Italy around 1894, and then in 1895 Malatesta went to England, and Gori went to Switzerland. He was in prison there, but then in 1895 he also moved to England, and so he joined forces with Malatesta again. And then Gori went to the United States, but then in 1897 both came back to Italy at the same time, and these 2 years, 1897 and 1898, were years of strong social struggle in Italy. And then again they left, and one went to the United States and the other to Argentina. So, the instances of simultaneous presence are mainly limited to two countries, Italy and England. And the case of Italy needs little explanation. Wherever emigration and exile brought these anarchists, Italy remained the principal, though not the exclusive focus of their activism. And it is precisely by virtue of this characteristic that we talk of Italian anarchism as a transnational movement. The case of England can be circumscribed to London, where all these militants lived. And though by no means it was the safe haven that it is often depicted to be, London offered refuge to anarchists and revolutionaries of all European countries. Its international anarchist community became the headquarters of continental anarchism, a center of cross-pollination of ideas, and a crossroads of transatlantic routes. Anarchists traveling between Europe and the Americas spent time in London and met local exiles, providing a link among groups across the Atlantic. So London's role in the anarchist transnational network was fundamental. Anarchists rarely held formal congresses. However, in London, as in a sort of permanent congress, information was exchanged, ideas were debated, and decisions were made. In contrast with Italy and England, Argentina and the United States were all visited at different times. Argentina is a foremost example of the cross-national involvement of anarchists of different countries in each other's movement. I make a distinction between transnationalism and cross-nationalism. When I talk, I mean, the word transnationalism is used in many different ways. The way I use it is specific. When I talk about a transnational movement, I refer to a national movement, for example, the Italian movement, spreading across the borders of the Italian territory. And when I talk about cross-nationalism, I mean the mutual involvement of anarchists of different countries in each other's movement. And so these Italian anarchists at the same time that they remained interested in the in Italy, they also got involved in the Argentinian movement and gave a powerful contribution to the labor movement in that country. And the other country is the United States. I wanted to give you a brief outline of the journeys that all of these three anarchists took in the United States. I'm not going into that, and I'm just going to refer you to a paper I published in 2007 in the International Review of Social History about anarchism as a transnational movement. And in that paper I show the continuity that these journeys made by the anarchists established in the relationship between anarchists in Italy and in the United States. So to sum up the main point of my presentation, these propaganda tools that Malatesta, Gori, and Merlino made in the United States illustrate the transnational Italian anarchist movement's significant continuity in time, as virtually all foremost Italian anarchist leaders came to the United States at one time or another. So those trips point to a sustained organic relationship between the leaders of the Italian anarchist movement and one important segment of that movement. I know that the word leader may be unpalatable to many of you, but I think that they were leaders in the sense that they were foremost figures and they were recognized as influential figures. And conversely, the collective transnational perspective on Italian anarchism provides the appropriate context in which the individual lives of its militants should be placed. The lives of Merlino, Gori, and Malatesta are paradigmatic in this respect. From a national perspective, their exiles through Europe, North Africa, and the Americas may appear as the wanderings of knights errant in and out of their country, an alternation of engagements with and disengagement from anarchism in Italy. From a transnational perspective, the same moves represent coherent itineraries within Italian anarchism, either in Italy or outside of Italy, with no interruption and no disengagement. Thank you.
All right. And finally, we have Jeffrey de la Fourcade with what I think is the longest title of the entire conference. Countercurrents and Oppositional Trends Within a Syndicalist Labor Tradition, Locating the Anarchist Influence on the Politics of Maritime Trade Unionism in Argentina, 1903 to 1950.
I figured if you just read the title, you didn't need the paper. The thing is, I came to the study of anarchism in general through labor. And I was a labor activist in France. France is a very verticalist country. The problem when you study labor is that unions always start out as these great experimentations and collective, you know, deliberation. And then they go into action, they get smashed, and then eventually the majority of the constituents decide that they would like to get some advantages from the power, you know, achieved, and so they develop these verticalist unions that get involved in negotiations with the state and everything, and the anarchists disappear, as you said, from the historiography all of a sudden. And then there's a resurgence whenever there's a crisis. The other problem is, I started by happenstance studying Argentina, and of course, as in most national histories and area studies, the story that I was told by my professors and that I had to contribute to was the rise of the state, of national identity, of welfare reform, people coming from all over the world and then realizing that they were truly Argentine and patriotic, and why they all loved Peronism and the neo-fascist state in the 1940s. And eventually hung on to a kind of nostalgic memory of the welfare benefits and the charitable benefits they got from Juana de Vita Perón in subsequent years of capitalist modernization and state formation. This is all very boring and very predictable. I was supposed to write about, what about those workers who didn't like the Peronists at first? And so my professor said, go look in the port, there are a bunch of crazy agitators, lots of anarchists, right? And lo and behold, I found a tradition that was, unlike most stories of anarchist history, you could find traces of it continually throughout the end of the 19th and all of the 20th century in different circumstances. So I decided I always talk about longshoremen because they were organized in a powerful resistance society known as the Sociedad de Resistencia Obreros del Puerto. And they actually still existed in the 1930s, in the 1940s, in the 1950s, and were very active in labor politics in Argentina, and then reappeared later on during the smashing of the welfare state in the 1980s, along with other kinds of anarchist movements and horizontalist movements that are very powerful in Argentina today. There's a tradition there. But the maritime unions, you know, the historians basically say, okay, basically they became syndicalists, accepted, you know, state regulation, they became this big industry, and then the anarchists kind of lose their influence. The story of anarchism in Argentina is always told this way. It emerges in the 1880s and 1890s. A bunch of immigrants come over, famous ones like Malatesta and Pietro Gori. They give conferences, people get excited. They argue between collectivists and individualists. The individualists want to throw bombs. The collectivists say, no, let's organize. The collectivists win. They have to compete with the socialist electoral tradition, which in Argentina and in Argentina only, other than maybe in Mexico and the revolution, was quite important. All the workers are disenfranchised, none of them can vote, so they rebel en masse, like the plebe. European historians love to make comparisons with the French Revolution in 1848 and the Commune. And then in 1902, big strike waves, all the way up to 1910, 1912, lots of action. And then, at that point, the Argentine Fora, the largest, other than the CNT, Federation of Anarchist Unions in the world, is at the height of its power. It is then smashed. And after a brief resurgence in 1916, 1919, after the war, the anarchist movement fizzled and it's no longer important. After that, you have syndicalist unions, communist unions, socialist unions, peronist unions, and anarchism was really effective only in cases when workers had absolutely no representation and no services and were therefore desperate, or in circumstances where it was a pre-modern, pre-industrial economy, artisans and itinerant, you know, casual laborers. They were only powerful or effective when they had no rights and were claiming rights, and then when those rights were granted, the anarchists became irrelevant. That's the story that we're told. Now, if you look at workers involved in unions connected to the ports, the first thing you find out is that the reason the anarchist movement was so powerful in Argentina, the primary reason to me, was that it was an export-led economy based on shipping and transportation along a whole system of rivers, roads, that all ended up in a small neighborhood in a small port area of, it was called La Boca del Riachuelo, near the modern port of Buenos Aires, so that it was possible to agitate locally in La Boca and affect, through economic sabotage and mass strike movements and propaganda tours and educational tours, the entire country. So that whenever there was a big strike in the port, the whole country was paralyzed, the government came and talked to the anarchists, and pleaded for, you know, some kind of reason, or the military stepped in. And so anarchism was relevant to national politics. If you look at their local communities, you find that they were loci of social experimentation and cultural effervescence. Labor historians always look for unions. I'll talk about that in a minute. They were actually resistance societies. But these people were effective only when they were deeply embedded in community life. That means that their assemblies were in the Teatro Verdi or in Sociedades de Benevolenza, Italian mutual aid societies. They were involved with all kinds of groups, women's groups. They debated with the socialists. They were not interested in suffrage, for obvious reasons. What they were interested in was equality. A lot of women activists got involved in labor movements where the workers were 98% male. They got involved as educators and as speakers and as, you know, political leaders. But their main interest was, they liked the uprootedness of the Argentine working class because it weakened the patriarchal family, which would have strengthened the church and the state. But they didn't like the fact that all these uprooted men were in whorehouses all the time. And so they worked on, you know, trying to come up with an anarchist policy of prophylactic social sanitation of the community life. They were also involved, obviously, in cooperatives and food distribution and stuff like that. Anarchists were never isolated from the society. When they were, they did tend to vanish. And they were always a very small number of people. So historians, we get excited when there's a big mass general strike, but then when it fails, we go, well, that didn't work. back to the drawing board. As David was saying, you know, anarchists tend to be very individualistic in their choices of where to appear and where to, you know, where to make a difference within the anarchist movement. Individuals were very important. They were always a very small group of people. What historians often miss is that many of them don't have famous signatures in newspapers or haven't written books. Many of them were working class activists and intellectuals and educators of this. If you're not careful, you can lose trace of them. But this small group of people, they could mobilize and influence hundreds and thousands of strikers and have, you know, an impact much beyond their number. It's okay to be a small group of people. The illusion that if you don't end up with 100,000 constituents who all agree with the anarchist way of organizing is what depresses a lot of people that study anarchism historically. When you look at labor unions, and you know, historians tend to find out, are they led by anarchists? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. When they're not led by anarchists, we lose interest. If they lasted, did they last long as permanent institutions? Did they become something to reckon with that's still around 100 years later? Almost never. That wasn't the point. You gotta understand what anarchists were trying to do. They were trying to unravel and deconstruct that kind of approach to class formation and representation completely. Also, did they win or did they lose? I find that one the most amusing, you know, because obviously the authoritarian socialists won in the 20th century, and look where that led us. All right. So forget about that Promethean kind of approach to the history and that chronological narrative of state formation for a minute. The anarchists were organized in resistance societies, which in Argentina were very powerful. They were small and they were defensive. It was one of the originalities of the Argentine/Latin American model. Resistance societies adopted anarcho-communism in 1905 and agreed with Malatesta around that time period in 1907 when they had the Congress in Amsterdam against the trade unionists, that unions were a place and working class protest was a place where anarchists could intervene and create the conditions for a transformation of consciousness that would empower the workers and lead to emancipation, but that they shouldn't become obsessed with reifying the institution of unions or class, because you know, you had to develop networks between different kinds of people. That was the most important thing. Horizontal networks. They didn't call it horizontalism. It's no accident that that tradition in Argentina is still very present in social movements today. Then they were organized in local working class federations, Federaciones Obreras Locales, which were in little ports all along the littoral of the Atlantic and the rivers of Paraná and Uruguay, and which basically were not unions. They were community organizations that tried to federate different kinds of social activism, protest, solidarity, and mutual assistance, as well as the distribution of propaganda and information and cultural activities locally in very small pobladas all over the country. Then there were the Federaciones Obreras Regionales, which tried to strategically define the future anarchist society as a grassroots federation of groups along regional lines, ignoring national boundaries, with the regions being all sort of coeval and equal among themselves. The Fuerza in Buenos Aires was not supposed to be in charge. Power was supposed to come from below, and everything was deliberative and assembly-based. And then at the top you had the Fuerza, the Federación Obrera Argentina, Regional Argentina, which everyone recognizes was a huge labor confederation, very powerful for a long time. But that was made up mostly of intellectuals, and especially journalists who were involved in La Protesta, the anarchist newspaper with the largest circulation in Latin America. They were not always in agreement with the stuff that the people decided in the Federaciones Obreras Locales or in the strike movements and in the unions. In fact, they were often very preachy. A lot of the problems we find with their concepts relating to gender relations, relating to culture and identity, all of these European reflexes and stereotypes and these kind of exaggerated literary representations of emancipation were popular among the intellectuals. The intellectuals coordinated the movement nationally, spoke for it, and left a lot of historical record, but they were just intellectuals. Let's not confuse the Fuerza with what's going on in the anarchist movement. Horizontalism was based on the spread of information and the use of direct action and involvement in organizing from below social services and forms of mutual assistance, cultural organizations, musical groups, bands, solidarity groups to protest for prisoners and against war and things like that. Anarchists always fought verticalism everywhere, but not only from the outside. they were present in other movements, in other institutions. And I think this is a very valuable lesson. I picked the maritime workers because that's a clear case. In, of course, the longshoremen organized a resistance society that had a very long life of roughly 4 to 5 decades before becoming marginalized for reasons I can't go into. But also, early in the 19th century, in the 20th century, the mariners and the firemen were the most important workers on the ship. The firemen are the ones that get the engine going, and the mariners are the ones that are basically the deckhands and the workers on board. They have a verticalist hierarchy that's almost military in the workplace. But these are the core workers on the ship. They had an anarchist resistance society that in 1906, 1907 merged with other sections of workers with different ideological proclivities into a syndicalist league, which later became the famous Federazione Obrera Marittima, the Maritime Workers Federation, which was the largest and most powerful syndicalist federation in the Argentine labor movement between 1910 or 14, mostly, all the way up to 1937. Within that federation, the anarchists always had one advantage. The syndicalists wanted federalism and decentralization as well, so they allowed local groups and local sections of the union to continue to function as they had before. All anarchists had to do was get in all the assemblies and get involved in all levels of union activity, and they could influence it, and they did. In my research, I found cases of this. Sometimes we're not even looking for anarchists, and they're there. There were also strong communities of immigrant anarchists in the shipyard, ship repair industry, which was very closely knit with the community. By the time I met Attilio Biondi, who was involved in the founding of the Federación Obrera y Construcciones Navales in the early 1900s, he was a man almost 100 years old who still couldn't speak Spanish. He still spoke Genoese. But he had been involved in 4 decades of activism in which he had belonged to almost every movement and shared tribunes with people who were nationalists or communists at various points in time. But he continued to believe that unless you have your taller, your small workshop where you can cooperatively hire and work with comrades and work with the community, unless you have that control over production in the sort of artisanal mode and that rootedness in the community, then you absolutely can't call yourself an anarchist. You're going to become a wage slave or an industrial worker. All of these people were strongly entrenched in the community. Whenever there were strikes, they were the ones who organized the soup kitchens. They were the ones who managed to collect money to give to workers who were idle and therefore not making any money. They were the ones who took care of the families. They were often the ones who actually, the working class anarchists from these different professions, who actually gave the classes in the rationalist schools that were created by anarchists all over Argentina to provide education among people who never received a formal education, were considered illiterate. I'm sure you've heard of that movement. They were always, again, in the 1920s, in the 1930s, early 1930s, late 1930s, and early 1940s, either out on the street and in their union hall, or hiding out somewhere in the port from persecution and working clandestinely. They never accepted nationalism, but cultivated instead regional solidarities. And these regional solidarities, by the way, made it possible for workers from Paraguay, Asunción, who came downriver for seasonal work in the ports, Uruguay, and other countries to become members of these resistance societies and local federations when they immigrated. So they became assimilated into the Argentine working class and society, if you'd like, via this illegal and sometimes clandestine mode, which was through anarchist activism. They were internationalists, anti-fascist and anti-militarists, but they were also totally against permanent institutions. A lot of times anarchists in the maritime industry would start a movement and be the main educators of the movement in terms of changing working conditions, improving health conditions at work, improving living conditions, creating low-cost tenement housing for workers and things like that. They'd be involved in these campaigns. And then, when the socialists or when the state got involved in institutionalizing some kind of mechanism, such as withholding money from the worker's salary for the pension and that kind of thing, they would back off, oppose it, say, you're going to lose your integrity if you allow the government to regulate this benefit, it has to be managed by us, right? And that's when the socialists or the peronists or the nationalists would take credit for social reform. But the workers were always there. I have examples. In 1944, there was a huge strike of longshoremen and mariners in the port of Buenos Aires that, again, reverberated throughout the country as it had in the 20s and earlier before that, that was actually led by anarchists and that ended up being celebrated by the peronists as an uprising of the workers against their foreign enemies. Why? Because it was at a moment when the anarchists, who were very influential in the workplace and the community, had a lot of clout with foreign shipping lines. They had developed it over the years. The peronist state says, we're going to nationalize, kick the foreigners out, which means we also have to kick out the foreign agitators who've been striking deals for four decades with these private companies. So the peronists ended up intervening the unions, the syndicalist unions where the anarchists were present, persecuting the leadership and the rank and file that were involved in anarchist activism, and then institutionalizing the life of the union along modern industrial lines with verticalist modes and an interventor and, of course, a state negotiator at a time when they were nationalizing industry and claiming to create national sovereignty. A lot of the workers that I interviewed and whose biographies I was able to study, especially in the 1930s and the 1940s, remember moments in which the community was galvanized in defense of the kinds of ideals that anarchists preached. Usually dignity, ethics, self, some kind of empowerment in terms of participation of people in collective decisions. And they took, in those moments where everybody agreed, regardless of their sympathy or even knowledge of anarchist ideology, they took that and ran with it, and it developed, it morphed into something bigger than what the anarchists intended. But right at the moment where their integrity would have been lost, they withdrew and continued to agitate to try to democratize from below. This was so much true, and I'll conclude with this, that when the peronist state fell in 1955 after a military coup, and there was a brief liberalization before the military came back, and the modern bureaucratic authoritarian capitalist state started taking hold. Where did the first big labor conflict erupt that claims to redefine the citizenship of workers in the new Argentine nation? In the shipyards, in La Boca, in the port of Buenos Aires, organized by the oldest anarchist resistance society in the port, the Shipyard Workers Federation. And that movement lasted for 2 years. It led to a lockout. All the workers were fired and replaced with new workers who had no political consciousness or roots in the community. Subsequently, over the next 3 decades, that community was completely trashed by urban sprawl, modern urban change, modernization, and of course, sheer repression. But during those 2 years, the anarchists came back and questioned the notion that somehow, by developing a bureaucratic, authoritarian, quasi-military state, workers had overcome the misery that they had experienced in the 20s and 1930s. They made alliances with students. They made alliances with women's groups because they recognized new issues such as reproductive rights and the need for some kind of new educational system as well as community-based cooperative solutions to problems of distribution, consumption, sanitation, and construction, much in the same way they do now in Argentina. These new horizontal movements came out in solidarity with the anarchists, as did the International Transport Workers Federation based in London, which is not anarchist by any stretch of the imagination, but realized that the main contribution of these workers over a long period of time had been the expression of freedom, participation, and openness to negotiated, deliberative forms of authority that could potentially democratize and make labor relations as well as citizenship more effective. They were smashed, but they're still revered. And I think when, just to conclude, I have minus 2 minutes left, I want to say that anarchists were the strongest when they focused on movements and issues and on societal and ethical choices not just interest. So they took what were economistic claims to a higher level. And that's when they got a huge impact on the community, because people are galvanized by that. They were also the strongest when they were flexible, weary of institutions, but willing to participate in them in order to forward their ideals, especially direct democracy. They were almost always non-sectarian, and when they turned sectarian, they would literally kill each other. When they had a fight over the Bolshevik Revolution, Rodolfo González Pacheco assassinated Emilio López Arango, who was one of the greatest theoreticians of the anarchist revolution. And when they posited themselves as a vanguard, which was often the case of the Fora and the intellectuals in La Protesta, and tried to find total solutions to the society's problems by projecting the future of humanity in the anarchist utopia, they totally lost touch with their constituencies and became more present to us in the archives and vanished completely from reports of, you know, their reality in everyday life. So I think we really have to look at, we have to remember what anarchists were trying to achieve. When we come to terms with the fact that they were not trying to achieve totality, but were working on processes, and that they took fragmentation, mobility, connectivity, solidarity, and the ability to adjust to new circumstances, make new alliances, and try to enforce a non-sectarian, deliberative culture of citizenship, that's when they created a permanence, if not physical, at least political, social, and cultural, that would, I think, nourish a lot of social movements and uprisings later in Argentina. Sorry about that.
All right, so let's open up to questions.
I didn't tell you half the story.
In back there.
So in contemporary Argentina and Chile, the Mapuche do a lot of collaboration with anarchists. I'm wondering if there's any sort of historical record of these folks in Buenos Aires and Argentina working with the Mapuche.
I'll take a few. There is one there.
My question is, how did the anarchist movement deal with the fundamental contradiction between the fact that they are working in a corporate, bureaucratic, international, economic production system and the fact that they're anarchists? Did they have some kind of transitional strategy, or were they just interested in processes and were willing to permit and accept and be subservient to a system of corporate internationalism? The question is relevant to me because that's what we have to deal with today. We are part of an international corporate system, and all I ever hear from anarchists is protest, protest, protest. They're not talking about how we build transitions away from that corporate system. So I'm really curious to know if they were thinking about that at that time and if they were developing transitional strategies for it.
Okay, thanks. Okay, and then I'll take Sandy next.
Great.
I should probably ask
the
question. So this is more kind of a methodological question as historians. These are wonderful. Thank you so much for the panel, all three of you. These are all histories of anarchists. What, in your opinion, do you make of anarchist history? So I'm thinking of, you know, James Scott, for instance, his most recent book, right? An anarchist history of upland Southeast Asia. Or, you know, even somebody like Pierre Clast. It's a particular interest to me because, you know, the part of the world that I'm interested in is, you know, certainly there's radical traditions everywhere in the world, we could say, but people aren't necessarily identifying as anarchists as such. You know, being an anarchist might not mean anything to them, even though we as anarchists would look at their organizational tactics and say, my God, you know, they're anarchists, if only someone would let them know, right? Or if that's, relevant. Point being, what do you make of the notion of anarchist histories versus, you know, histories of anarchism or anarchists?
All right, let's take another bench. So, you want to get that first?
Can I touch on all three in 2 minutes? First, the quick question, the quick answer to your question about indigenous folks. The intellectuals, and especially the European educated ones in La Protesta and in Buenos Aires, didn't know much about indigenous societies. Because of the local organization of the four of them and the structure that I described to you, they were constantly involved in defending indigenous causes, especially up in the Chaco and in Paraguay, where they defended indigenous workers in many, many opportunities. And they weren't the only ones. By the way, they always worked hand in hand with other folks, socialists especially. But the main contribution, I think, to the classical anarchists, the awareness of the existence of indigenous polities with their own interests and their, also their need for networking and solidarity, is this belief that I've studied elsewhere than in Argentina, that cultural groups and societies are always small scale and locally based. So it's hard to adapt kind of universalist solution to everybody's problems. The solution to that is you let them organize that, you know, self-sufficiently as Mapuche and define themselves as Mapuche Say, right? Which is a transnational movement in the Southern Cone. And then you look at the causes, ecological, economic, education, etc. And then you network with them on their terms and create movements of solidarity. They did this with various indigenous groups throughout the Americas, not just in Argentina, at the level of the four. They were vaguely aware. They never really understood these movements, and often these movements would not bring leadership to the larger movement in Buenos Aires. But because of the organizational structure, federative, locally based, and always bottom-up, those indigenous voices were present. The world's changed now, though. And that brings me to a part of another question that was asked. Interestingly, classical anarchists had to work in a circumstance. They believed in Enlightenment ideals. They believed in progress, right? They believed in rationalism. They believed in the chronology of time. They believed in radical change and vanguardism. Artistic, technological, we're all aware of this, right? Well, we can't sort of take that from classical anarchists and reinvent it today, because what's happened is that whole industrial world fell apart, our theories of progress have fallen apart, our hermeneutics have changed, social movements have changed. What you can understand, though, to help understand the transition, is that anarchists are more comfortable networking internationally, trans-regionally, than they are working in the enclosure of a nation state. They're more comfortable working for causes that are bigger than them, transnational, than they are working for laws or rights at the national level that are based on electoral or parliamentary politics. So I think that's why anarchism has suddenly resurged in various forms all around the world, because we've lost a lot of those national certainties, as well as, you know, I'm from Europe, right? So an anarchist who likes to think that anarchism is part of the socialist revolutionary tradition, which it is often annoyed by ecologists and greens coming out of Germany and now France, where, you know, they support federation, they support grassroots democracy, they support the empowerment of communities and regionalism, but ultimately, they never support class conflict. But still, they come from, they're part of the libertarian tradition as well, you see? And what they've done is they brought ecological concerns that classical anarchists didn't have at all back. And they've done that because their organizational structure cannot create totalities and cannot allow one group to easily hegemonize, if you'd like, another and create a kind of national-based solution. So when we study, to get to that question about an anarchist history versus history of anarchists, the history of anarchists is interesting because it's been like the history of, say, black people in the Atlantic diaspora and the formation of nations or something like that, right? Or the history of indigenous peoples. Because of forms of coloniality, let's call them like that, because of symbolic power and ideological power and not just material power, they've been erased from our collective memory. A lot of times you can say for structural reasons, like the neighborhood of La Boca is now, you know, out of bounds. I can't even go to my favorite places historically because it's run by drugs and bandits and police. So the topic, you know, the urban ecology has changed. The places and the locations where anarchists are have changed. The class structure of the world has changed. But what's really important is one of the ways to break down our own academic, intellectual, and kind of forced way of creating these narratives and these stories to explain the past is to get under the skin of the actors of the history and try to understand how tentative and contradictory and laced with psychological and social complexities their everyday existence was. You know, once you realize that, you abandon this story. I'm not really trying to tell you that anarchists were really great because they kept getting smashed and kept coming back and long live the anarchists. What I'm saying is actually, if you look closely enough, they're worker bees, they're everywhere, and it heartens me to know that every form of authoritarianism can ultimately be challenged, including within the anarchist family. Remember, most of these people have families. And so the politics of the anarchists, I think, classic anarchists and historical experience, can inform us to try to deal with the complexities of struggles for liberation today, which have become more fashionable in some sense, more individualized, a lot more youth-based anarchist movements than there used to be. Class isn't such a fundamental question. There are all these things. But anarchists had insights into those things. And I have a private life that I hide from people. I write fiction. I used to be an actor. I'm a social activist, and I like to record old people's stories. And I apply an anarchist phenomenology and methodology to those activities. As an academic, I try to tell, you know, make sense of a complex past and give voice to actors of history that have often been silenced.
I was wanting to speak to the last question by the gentleman in the red hoodie at the back there, with regards to part of the question I was hearing was, you know, are these people anarchists? Do they consider themselves anarchists, or is there like a reading of anarchists, anarchism into what their behaviors, et cetera, et cetera? So, with my own research, part of it was drawn from the anarchist newspapers, of which I talked about Il Martello and La Donata dei Refrattari. So you have people that are actively involved in that, either as editors or having some kind of other function in the publication of the paper, very easily identifiable as anarchist by politic. Even, you know, various, some are anarcho-syndicalists, some are like anarchist-communists who don't believe in organization, et cetera, et cetera. But another source that informed my research are security files that were collected by the Italian state on these people. So in many circumstances, these folks are being labeled anarchists by, in many cases, of fascist informants working for a vice consul in places like Sault Ste. Marie or Detroit or Windsor, et cetera, right? So this becomes difficult. How do you determine whether these people actually identified as such? You know, some of that is based on the evidence that these files contain, where they, you know, maybe they attended certain meetings, or they, you know, again, it's problematic for sure, but in those circumstances, you try to find evidence of their politics from other sources, whether they've already been published or other kind of primary sources. So it does get a bit tricky.
Yeah, I want to answer to both questions. The first one about the transition. I think that if you look at the history of anarchism, they have this image of being impossibilists, of wanting all or nothing. But if you look at the history of anarchism, they've always been involved in day-to-day struggle. The Chicago martyrs fought for the 8 hours work day, and anarchists of the, for example, like Malatesta, they preached the involvement in unions. And Malatesta said, there's no fight which is too small to be worth fighting. So, but the principle, which I think is almost universal in anarchism, is the coherence between ends and means. And so they refused means of struggle whenever these means were in contradiction with their ends. And so, for example, they refused parliamentarianism as a mean of struggle, because it barred it. They acknowledged that something could be done in parliament, for example, but that barred from further progress along the path that they wanted to follow. So this principle of coherence between ends and means is what makes the difference between struggles they wanted to fight, means they wanted to use, and what they didn't want to do. And to the other question, what I'm going to say is very tentative, but to me, the best way of framing hypothetical anarchist history is to put it in contrast with Marxist historiography. So Marxism, the fundamental principles of Marxism and Marxist historiography are methodological holism. They look at society first, and then individuals are sort of reflection of society, following the necessary dynamics of society. social determinacy and determinism. And the way I see anarchist historiography is the opposite. If you look at historians like even Max Netlau or Paul Avrich, I think that the principles you can see there are methodological individualism. Society is construed as the result of the interaction of individuals. And following from this, you have voluntarism and social indeterminacy. I think this is one way, the way I draw the divide between anarchist historiography and Marxism.
That last one's very important because they did construct social subjects. They talk about proletariat, they talk about the people. But their approach to the construction of the subject was always tentative, relational, and transitory. Mm-hmm. It was never about a kind of teleological building blocks of stages of modernization. They understood that the collective subject is something that was galvanized in the consciousness of people for a time, and then had to be constantly, the flame had to be continued somehow. So the methodological anarchism of somebody like Peter Linebaugh, who's an anarchist historian, with Marcus Rediker, work on the Atlantic World, The Many-Headed Hydra, I don't know if you ever read that. He never talks about the working class, but he describes, almost with artistic, talent, a kind of tapestry of colors, really what working life meant, who was involved, and when those workers got involved in collective action, how they came to see the world in that way. It was not definitive, it wasn't permanent, but it was an important moment of cultural and social formation.
Right. Next question is you, and then you.
I'm really grateful for this panel. It's been one of the most entertaining I've been to thus far. And
entertaining?
And informative and educational. Forgive me if my understanding of history right now is naive. I'm only recently embraced my Italian heritage and talked to my nonna and looked at the history of anarchism in Italy. But I guess this question is to all of you, because I think, well, given the presence of Italians in Argentina, and I think Saverno Giovanni was here?
Yeah.
I guess I'm interested in the cultural or historical circumstances that seem to have made the practice of propaganda by the deed and similar practices so prevalent, at least in my understanding of history, within the Italian anarchist tradition, such that there are mass deportations in various countries of Italians in particular. So I guess, yeah, I'm curious as to why that form of praxis seems to have been so influential amongst Italian anarchists.
I actually wanted to, when you brought up the Many-Headed Hydra, I wanted to ask you if you think it's possible to draw lines of connection between the early modern radical transatlantic experience that Linebaugh and Rediker talk about, and the maritime workers in the turn of the century. Did you hear about things like the general strike in Chile when the boats come in, all those sailors are jumping off and joining the strikers right there? And that network, that radical world actually on the Atlantic and not within any of these countries, but that in-between space of transition, which isn't really talked about a lot in the modern, because most of transatlantic studies is really early modern Atlantic studies. How anarchist historians like you could approach that area in relation to the Hydra. But I don't think the Hydra died in 1830, right? Like, so.
Some of these sort of things in history that have been made invisible, things that have been made not invisible but unintelligible, incoherent. And I was thinking about also some of the references to anarchist poetry and drama and culture. I may have misconstrued that you were speaking to sort of the impatience that we can have sometimes with rereading some of this stuff. It seems like anarchist romance is full of cliches and idealism, and it doesn't read well anymore. I'm wondering if part of that reaction that I mean I have it too. Is coming from another kind of sort of invisibility slash incoherence that's filtering between us and it, which is that we've been kind of tainted by modernist prejudices. We've absorbed ideas like Eliot's, you know, modern poetry has to be indirect. You can't say anything directly. Pound, make it new. Don't use old forms. William Carlos Williams, no ideas but in things. Don't just say things like liberty in a poem.
Also, science means something different to us now. Pietro Gori was a sociologist and a psychologist, right? He was influenced by the science of his time and is completely passé. That doesn't make Pietro Gori any less of an anarchist.
He was an admirer of Lombroso.
Yeah, they had some crazy ideas, and you know, they believed in science as the replacement of religion, remember? I mean, we've totally lost that. As well as, they thought progress was around the corner. They were apocalyptic, like a lot of modernists at the time. Everything was going to fall apart and we could reconstruct from anew. That brings me to the Italian question, quickly. One of the problems, I come from the old left, okay, so I landed in the unions, and I tell you a story of anarchists that sounds coherent, but remember, I made a choice. That's not the only anarchism. Argentina was and all of Latin America, there were all kinds of forms of anarchist practice that had nothing to do with workers or unions or organization. That was the most spectacular, and it's one that happens to interest me. But there were clubs, groups, circles. There were individualists, there were gauchos, there were people in the rural areas that identified with the Montoneras, and there was resistance against the rise of the central state. And, of course, there were Italians who, in Argentina, it's more than half the people have descendants who are Italian. The Italians brought a lot of their ideas. Mazzini, Garibaldi, and all these people, they had their societies. There's actually in La Boca an organization called the Republic of La Boca, which has officially seceded from Argentina. And it's a bunch of old aristocrats, you know, reactionaries, whose main objective is to persecute the anarchists in their own community. The anarchists created all kinds of utopian cooperatives and in the rural areas and the cities. They did different things, and they're most famous for the Di Giovanni terrorism, which is what it was, right? Throughout Argentine history, especially when the organized movement is crushed and the state is on a rampage and workers have no means of expression, there are various examples of which Di Giovanni is the most famous of what they call themselves usurpers of authority, and they went around committing atentados, assassinations essentially, and bombs to try to create chaos to attract attention to themselves. And Di Giovanni was in that way very similar to a lot of revolutionaries in Europe, especially in Italy, and he modeled himself, and he's a popular hero. Those kinds of folks never had any following among ordinary workers in labor movements or social movements, but they were popular icons in theater, in storytelling, and stuff like that.
I want to answer the question about propaganda by the deed. And first of all, I think that the term propaganda by the deed has been misconstrued in that it has come to mean exclusively terrorism and bombing. But originally it meant something different, and it always meant something different for some anarchists. And it meant to me, the meaning of propaganda by the deed comes very close to direct action, in the sense that propaganda by the deed is a deed, it's action, but at the same time it has a propaganda value. It doesn't have to be terrorism or bombing. It's just direct action that has a propaganda value. And in this sense, it's always been there in the anarchist movement.
Economic sabotage.
Yeah, exactly.
Destroy the engine, the ship won't move. Yeah.
And the,
they'll never know.
And the other thing is that also this identification of the Italian anarchist movement as mainly devoted to propaganda by the deed is also a misconstruction that comes from the way anarchists have been represented. In Italian anarchism, as in other movements like the Spanish or the French, there has always been a debate between two main currents. In Italy they were called the organizationists and the anti-organizationists. And the organizationists were always for involvement in the labor movement, collective struggle, struggles for partial gains, economic or even legal struggles. Whereas propaganda by the deed in the worst sense was more practiced and advocated by the anti-organizationists. But by no means the anti-organizationists were predominant in the Italian anarchist movement. They may have been at some times. They may have been, for example, in the Italian colony in the United States, but not in the Italian anarchist movement overall.
And then just to add on to what Davina said, it's also this idea too that if you can, for those who engage in propaganda by a deed to mean something like assassination, of course. This was an idea that you could somehow, as anarchists, assassinate this king or this prime minister, and this would somehow show that this could attack the state, that this action would spark a wider movement, even though the groundwork in cases hadn't been done, no community building, it was just these kinds of different actions. But again, also to add on to what David has said, even for those who, you know, in North America, who might have identified as anti-organizationalist anarchists, most of them, you know, weren't involved in actually assassinating political figures of one sort or another, right? Like, they might have cracked some fascist skulls in Detroit on a Columbus Day, you know.
They were very capable of violence, just like any other social movement.
Yeah, and again, where it plays into more of a direct action. So the fascists are going to march in Detroit on Columbus Day, and there's 60 of them, there's 9 of us, but that's not going to impede us from trying to break up this march.
80% of our sources are police records. So every anarchist I've ever learned about had prostitutes, beat his wife, was a terrorist, you know, because yeah, that stuff comes into force. But quickly, I'd like to answer that beautiful question, which is...
That wasn't the case in the my...
No, I mean, it was all allegations, of course. But I want to ask the question, what happened to the Hydra? I love that question. You should write a book, what happened to the Hydra?
The Hydra lives, right?
You know, that idea, I mean, think about it for a second. Are working people throughout the world who are victimized by capitalism but who have some agency over their lives and use that agency to form coalitions and movements and things like that, are they now, more than they were in, say, the early 19th century, any less differentiated, hybrid, mixed, capable of all kinds of follies but also of genius, sometimes completely silent, sometimes just all of a sudden occupying the streets and causing revolution? We have to, I think, conceptually do something. It was very hard for me because I'm a Frenchman, right? I was raised to believe that revolution and dictatorial states were the summum of human creativity. I realized that the nation state, as we view it, is this inevitable stage of modernization that now populates the entire planet territorially, is a very recent invention. In many places, it's still tentative and failing. It only, the Hydra vanishes from our imagination in the late 1890s when these nation states start becoming tentacular, territorial police states, you know, that try to engineer their societies in more hierarchical ways. Before that, you see a lot of many-headed Hydra. And because if you base your analysis on circulation and flows of peoples of ideas, obviously people on ships in the age of steam, sail and steam, were going to bring those ideas all over the world and fertilize the resistance, or fan the resistance to the nation-state. But now that the nation-state, barely 80 or 100 years later, has all of a sudden become questioned and evanescent, and, you know, we don't know exactly what to think of it anymore, there are all kinds of other forms of circulation and networking and complexity in the world today that are being used exactly the same way that sailors used to use their position in the Atlantic world or in any part of the world to become sort of, organic intellectuals of societal change and experimentation. It's just happening in different places, so find your networks. I found anarchists, among the nomads of the Sahel in Africa, who had no idea they were being anarchists. And right now, I've been hanging out in Cuba, as I've been telling my friends, with folks in these Frerian educational cooperatives who are practicing in their everyday lives an anarchism that can only be called anarchism if you know anything about anarchists, but they live in Cuba. They've never heard of anarchists. They'll be offended if you tell them that.
All right. I want to thank the panel. Thank you.